Okay, so I have to say two things. First of all, no, actually three things. It's joint work with Javier, and I'm somehow giving the talk part one of his talk, so this is a good thing. So I'm not assuming you remember everything he said in this talk. I hope that's okay. And the other part is that I was not there when they decided I had to speak. I was absent, so I claim to be completely innocent, but of course that's a different story. So let's start, and the point here is I want to not only talk about the results, but maybe a little bit where they come from, and I hope there's some part which tells actually the right story. And the starting point for the story is really very, very classical. The whole point about this embedding theory is really that at some point there are inequalities behind that, and they are probably more important than some of the results. And one of the most important inequalities is Kinchin's inequality anyway, which tells you that if you have plus minus one random variables which are independent, then the LP norm of these random variables can be calculated. It's always the expectation probably shouldn't be there. But anyway, it's always the L2 norm, whatever you do, and this holds for all p between 0 and infinity, and if I use the symbol A, the tilde CB, this always means multiplicative up to some constant, because I would use it all the time, and again, not my fault. Symbolically, you could just read that as L2 embeds into every LP 0 less than E less than infinity. So that's the first embedding result, just somehow reread from the classical Kinchin inequality. And the other motivation, it comes from Q-stable variables, which are, really a classical object in probability. And so what is the definition of a Q-stable variable? There is such a variable, so that if you calculate the Fourier transform, it gives you a nice object, namely this exponential minus CQT to the power Q. And then you have to show that there are these guys which do that. That's a nice exercise as well, but they are. And if you read that, then it actually shows that LQ embeds it to LP, just using these random variables. And how is that done? Well, we take, here things are a little bit better, so we take the expectation of the LP, we calculate the LP norm of linear combinations, and the point is that because these theta k's are independent, you don't really calculate the LP norm, you calculate the distribution. And if you calculate the distribution, then this exponential function is so helpful that you see immediately if the Q norm of the coefficient is 1, then they all have the same norm, and that's how you prove it. So the point, I have a restriction here, P less than Q, is the point is that except for the exceptional case Q equals 2, there are some integrability constraints on these Q stable variables. They are not always, they don't belong to every LP, but to certain ones. Okay. Yes, I did. And there is actually, so these are really motivations from the probability side. There's also a very nice bonus space result, starting with the work of Kravina and then really put to the point by Mouret and Pizier, which says that these LP spaces are not just there for fun, they actually tell you a lot of a Banach space. I mean, if you have a Banach space, then there are certain indices for which you can put LP in this Banach space. I mean, okay, it's not capital LP, I mean, we have to do finite dimensional versions for this, but up to an epsilon and for every n, these guys, we can find these subspaces which look like LP spaces and a certain range, and the range here is given by an P0, it's everything between P0 and 2, and then an endpoint Q0. Right? So we find a lot, in principle, you can find a lot of these finite dimensional spaces in a Banach space, and these endpoints should give you some information about what kind of space are we looking for here. Now, to tell you the truth, this program in the operator space setting is probably completely shattered by all these counting examples which we have seen. I mean, I don't really believe that there is such an analog, because operator spaces are a little bit too flexible. We have seen so many count examples by Hoyberg that I don't really believe that there is an operator space version of this result, but maybe there are some operator spaces where we can say something. I mean, maybe some are better behaved than others, and these are the ones we want to find. Okay, so behind the scenes, we always have independent variables. Whenever we want to prove an embedding result, we probably have to do some inequalities, and we have seen Rontal's inequality for p bigger than 2. So if p is bigger than 2 and you have the sum of independent random variables, what is important is not the right-hand side. What is important is there is a formula which you can work with. And for p less than 2, there's also formula. And we have seen that before, that, okay, for p bigger than 2, there is a plus, or actually a maximum, to be really honest. And for p less than 2, you have to take an int. And this is just duality, and it's not something we are really... It's just there, right? I mean, sometimes you have to we have to just accept that for p bigger than 2, it's a maximum formula. For p less than 2, it's an int. That's what we have to work with, and whether we like it or not. And there are nice corollaries, which are, of course, well known. For instance, if you take the intersection, this is a commutative LC space over the interval 0 infinity, intersected with L2, this is isomorphic to the space LP of 0, 1 for p bigger than 2. And for p less than 2, you have to take the sum. This is a well-known result, and of course you use this Palczynski decomposition trick, which we have learned, we had a nice recall of this in Buffa's talk. Yeah? So these are classical results that certain spaces are isomorphic, and you see this intersection sign here refers to this plus, which is the maximum, and the sum here comes up here. So this is kind of natural. It's natural to be expected. So that gives you an idea where these inequalities show up. Okay, so there are operator values examples. For sums of independent random variables. So again, we have, how to say that? There is a family of examples of random variables which are somehow generalizing Bernoulli variables. And they all have the same behavior, which I somehow try to write down for p equals 1. So there is a set of variables xk, so that if I tend to with arbitrary matrices ak, so these xk's are fixed, and these ak's here are arbitrary coefficients, then the norm of this cell, one norm of this object here, is given by all decompositions. And I mean, you know that in non-commutative things, the star on the one-hand side and the star on the other side, this is not the same, so you somehow have to make a compromise. The compromise is taking the int both those possibilities, and that's a Kinchin-type inequality, and which in most of the cases I'm citing now are due to, actually all of the cases, are due to Bézier or Bézier-Descartes. So good examples for this are the classical plus minus one Bernoulli variables. The independent Gaussian would also be an example for the XK. But it turns out also the generators of the free group also the same kind of starts to get very monotone. I mean, so in some sense, actually we proved later that whenever you have subsymmetric generators of arbitrary discrete group, you will always find the same thing. Whenever you have a nice discrete group with a nice trace, whatever you write down, you end up with this Kinchin inequality. Free probability, same story, either the circular or semicircular. Whatever you write down, you always end up with this right-hand side. It was like a law of nature. And so this is before we actually had some idea how to do things a little bit differently, but that has somehow, this observation somehow got us stuck for a long time, because whatever we can write down and calculate, this was always the same. And by the way, not this operator space weight, which we were interested in. But anyway, so here is the starting point of the story. This was really funny. So this is probably 89, I don't recall exactly. So we had this funny idea, actually Julia and myself. So this was the following reason, which is really nice. So let's assume we know that OH embeds into L1 for a second, yeah? Then we can form this tensor product, the projective tensor product between the columns of O and OH. And we've learned a lot about projective tensor product. The only thing you have to know is that as a Banach space, we can't calculate this. It's not so difficult. It's the Schatten 4 over 3 class, okay? So the reasoning is like this. If OH embeds into L1, then this Schatten 4 over 3 class has to also embed in some non-commutative L1. This was really the starting point of the whole argument. And at that point, it was nothing was known. It was really kind of an innocent state. And we didn't really know whether F4/3 and can embed in L1. We had an expert there who, it was not in the room. He said, maybe that is chain 2. Maybe F4/3 can embed. And then we were very happy and enthusiastic. Oh, that's good. I mean, now we know OX can never go there. And we have a game plan how to do things. We just proved that F4/3 doesn't embed them. And what I'm telling here is that every assumption in this argument is wrong. I mean, everything is wrong. It's just everything worked exactly the way we didn't thought it would work. But so it's really really cool. But it still gives the right orientation to find the result. So we shattered one hope after the other in the right order, and that's how it worked. But I have to tell you something. This is actually funny because this F4/3 you get over here is not the one we were thinking it should be, right? I mean, the one which was defined before by PCAs is a symmetric version, and this is one of these, Javier talked a lot about these asymmetric guys. This is one of these asymmetric guys which somehow in this argument appeared in a very natural way. And what actually is true that this asymmetric, if you take the column and the right version, I mean, we have seen that before, right? If you interpolate between row and columns, whatever this interpolation is, if you do it in the middle, you get the right object, yeah? So we have to somehow make a compromise between the columns and the right all the time, right? Compromise between columns and right. That's the philosophy of all the talk, and there we go. And I think the really starting point for being able to do this are inequalities from free probability. For me, this Boyko-Lesko inequality is really a version of Rosenthal's inequality in L infinity, and let me just recall this. So if you start with a free product of von Neumann algebras and you amalgamate over some B, then the question is, what is the norm of the sums of independent copies? And as I said before, in usual probability, you don't have a way to calculate this, but here you have. And Boyko-Lesko, I think, more or less only used this in passing. I mean, for him, this was needed for some estimates. This was not really a big deal. But it turned out to be a big deal for us. So the norm here can be given by three terms. Sum of mean zero variables is the subnorm of the individual components. That's something you have to accept. I mean, that will be there whatever you do, just by taking conditional expectations. But the second term is really amazingly small because you're essentially going back to the conditional expectation. So that the right-hand side is smaller than the left-hand side is not at all a surprise. But that there are, I mean, up to a constant 2 isomorphic is really surprising. The proof is surprisingly easy, and it's just a generalization of Boyko-Lesko's argument. Okay, there is a counterpart, a more Gaussian counterpart for these generalized semi-circular random variables, which are defined by a weight on the left. On this is supposed to be creation, that's supposed to be emulation. I know you can argue about the stars here, but one is one and one is the other. You put some weight, and this gives random variables in, first of all, in B of L2, on some large Hilbert space, a Fock space, of course. And what is actually not so hard to show is that if you take these random variables, you have what we call a weighted Kitchen inequality now. So you see that here we have these lambda k's and mu k's show up in one with the star here and one with the star here. So it's not so symmetric anymore. We can somehow tilt this. But what is, so actually proving this alone is not so hard. But what is important in this is the over part, namely that these guys are not just operators in DFL2, but there's a von Neumann algebra, there's a modular element, there you can calculate the modulo. So somehow it's a category that these are objects in a von Neumann algebra with nice properties where you can control the modular group. That is what makes these things important. And actually, the second, I want, okay, I will come back to this later. So here are some applications. These guys were used to show the operator space Grothendieck inequality, Bartlet and Schachtenko. I mean, not only this inequality, but further properties. And we have seen some of these properties again in Magdalena's talk. And what I already mentioned here is this weighted, I mean, so the right-hand side defines this weighted columns and rows, it's just a definition. Now, that the right-hand side is this maximum between these different weights we have seen, but what is important, that was observed later, that the subspace is already complemented. And there are many models for this kind of argument. I mean, the model for this is that the generators in the free group are complemented. There have been arguments before, or the span of the Gaussians were complemented. So there are many models for why this space should be complemented, but it turns out to work in this case as well. And that has some kind of nice consequences right immediately. Namely, you can apply duality. Now we have a von Neumann algebra. This is in a von Neumann algebra. You can apply duality. Projections and duality works well. So if you can put intersections with weights in a von Neumann algebra, you can take sums in the pre-dual. Yeah, this is just really duality. Duality between sums and intersections. And then it was actually known that OH embeds into such a weighted sum. Now, I have to say, it was known, but I found a different proof for that. But at any rate, so once you know that that you have those kind of objects in the pre-dual of the von Neumann algebra, and you know that this OH, whatever it is, embeds as a subspace of such a sum, then you know that OH embeds into an argument of L1 space. Okay. And here is actually the reason. Yeah, it's so funny because it became some of the building block for half of the papers we are working on last year, but it was, honestly, it was an exercise. We just put in the exercise because it's so easy and so elementary to prove. And so here is it. Okay, here's the definition of this operator space for H. There's row, there's columns, and OH is just in the middle. Yeah, and there is this complex interpolation method. Oh, complex interpolation method. So there are these analytic functions. Yeah, analytic functions on the strip between 0 and 1. So, yeah, so the real part is I times R. The imaginary part is 1 plus I times R. And then you consider all analytic functions. That's the first ingredient of the definition. And then you take all of them, and then you have to take the infimum over all analytic functions with the certain value in the middle, maybe 1/2, and then you take certain norms on the strip. So what you see is this is an abstract definition. It's not a definition you can write down immediately. You have to do some work in order to get this definition working or to make calculations. And PTA's exercise actually does that. I mean, here is this is the first order approximation of making this more concrete, if you want. So there are these spaces, L2 of IR, so these are functions as well as in L2, L2 of 1 plus IR, don't forget this is both on the strip. And then we have a way of putting OH somehow as space of constant functions in this quotient space. And you have to quotient by the space of all analytic functions with values in L2, which vanish at 1/2. So that's the definition. And here, this is already a simplification because, no, that's not what I want. Here's the simplification because here we are using a Hilbert space and here we are using a Hilbert space. So original definition works with L infinity. And it is true, and that is actually in the exercise, that you can do row and column here. You have to work a little bit, it's not so difficult. So this means we have a way to write OH somehow in a weighted sums of columns and rows. That's the message, right? If you now allow weighted sums, then things are better. And so in particular, we have a weighted sum. And here, okay, I'm suppressing one little fact here. This is the subspace here, this H 0, 1/2. But since we are working with Hilbert spaces, this is the graph of an unbounded operator. You diagonalize it, and that's how you get your coefficient. So it's not an easy exercise to calculate the coefficient. That's a different story. But actually, we know the coefficients because he had a very nice way of rewriting this, and his work gives us precise coefficients if we ever want to have them. And that is not important for this kind of corollary. It was not important how the coefficients look like, but in future work it will be. So that's PDA's exercise. And Javier talked about our embedding results. Our embedding results are essentially just the tensor product of PDSS. She does do it twice. We were just not expecting it to be that simple, but okay, see. So here is the story. The Sutton P class is, as we have seen before, the Hartree tensor product. The Hartree tensor is really fundamental for this argument. We speak of a certain CP and a certain RP, right? I mean, CP is defined, it's just the right P which works. And here, this P between 1 and 2, of course, is important because, because this, now I have to explain something. So, here is this CP, yeah? Before, we have seen that OH is the weighted sum between row and column. But, you know, if you do complex interpolation, you can play this game for other range of indices. So now we put the CP here and interpolate between column. I think I just screwed it up. I think here should be row and no. So here should be row and OH, and here should be column and OH. But it's anyway symmetric, but not in this. I mean, here this is an R, and that is a C. What is important is that these guys actually just is in the middle of these two, and this guy is in the middle of these two in some weighted fashion. Yeah? And this is really important. This should be a row, and this should be a column. Okay. And there is a way to write down PDE's exercise tensor for arbitrary polynomial algebra. The only problem is it's hard to write down. The idea is the same thing, and you have to use this amalgamated Hartree tensor product. It's more, you know, it's just what you have to do. I mean, it takes a little while. It is somehow just simulating the general tensor product, but of course, arbitrary polynomial algebras are not matrix algebras. We all know that they are a little bit more complicated in nature, so we should expect a little bit more of an algebraic complication. But the point is, whatever we can say in this situation, if you think about it enough, there is an analog of this if you invent the right spaces, and they are just invented to make that work. So, for instance, this L4 column here has this structure that somehow interpolates. So in somehow this there are just certain properties we have to check, certain algebraic properties. What is important here is not this formula, which is just lengthy, but the only thing which counts is that we are bound by the fact that we have to use nice product formulas for norms. That's the kind of the thing. We have to use these algebraic formulas because everything is somehow based on writing things as a product in a certain way. So it's really, there are algebraic constraints which lead us to this expression. It's not that we wanted that at the beginning, but we have to do this because essentially because of the functoriality of the Hartree tensor product. I mean, this guy tells us what to do. There's not, after that, there's not much you can do. Okay, so what are applications of the tensor for follow along? LP is completely isomorphic to a subspace of. Yeah, no, actually that's interesting. So, yeah, here, let's go back 1 second. So, if you look at this formula here, you can actually, I mean, the Hartree tensor product had this injectivity and a surjectivity property, so you can actually redistribute. So if you have a plus and a times, then you apply usual rules. It's this times that, and this times that, and this times that, and well, four guys, right? So what do we have? L2 times L2, that's L1, okay? L4 times L4, that's L2. Okay. L4 times L2, that's L4 over 3. L2 times L4, that's L4 over 3, just by Hodler's inequality. So, I mean, what I'm saying is we don't have a choice. I mean, this formula is just completely deterministic. We have to use these analytic functions because we have to work with interpolation. Once we have done that, we have a completely deterministic situation where we use, and here they are again, right? I mean, L1, well, that's not a big surprise. L2, that's also not a big surprise. But we have to use these weighted L4 row and L4 column, and somehow in order to compensate this with those, remember there is this unbounded operator coming from the complex interpolation functor. That's the guy which provides these weights. I mean, these are really weights. They are strictly semi-finite, so these are generalized states which in a generalized state, but there are some coefficients and they're not really bounded. So writing it down is a little bit of an issue, but the philosophy is quite clear. And we have nice applications because, and that is probably even a little bit surprising, for every quotient of the subspace of R and OH, and for every quotient of the subspace of C of OH, the same trick works. I mean, what we did before, this is somehow functorial. So we can actually find an embedding of the tensor product of two of these nice spaces in such a one sum for all of them. You know? So here we have something which is, if you think about the Banach space case, oh, I just realized the color is gone here. Anyway, in the Banach space case, you only have L2. And so there are not many two L2s you can actually talk about. So the Hilbert space tensor product between L2 and L2 is L2. So there's only one interesting Banach space object. But in operator spaces, there are just millions of interesting L2s. And if you take the right ones, then the Hartree tensor product is again a good object. That's what this formula is telling us. Indeed, now we will see an application of this later. So this is somehow the heart of the matter. I mean, I said before that at some point it's about inequalities. I mean, we have this abstract description in terms of factorization. On the other hand, we have inequalities which allow us to handle these objects. And to go back for a second, so this is a long sum. Technically, I'm better in intersections than in sums, because if I have to write down all decompositions, I'm getting a little bit nervous. And actually, I don't really know how to do this anyway, but duality allows me to go from sums to intersections. So we are playing this game back and forth all the time. And that's what it is. So what we realize is there is a complicated version of Voigt-Kolesko's inequality, but that's what it is. It's an extension of Voigt-Kolesko's inequality, which provides four terms. Yeah? So we are just counting. Four terms sounds good, right? Actually, we made the mistake of counting wrong for a long time, and then we realized that four terms is better than three, and that was the breakthrough at some point. Anyway, so what is the point here? Again, we go back to the free probability situation. So this is an inequality which has not much to do with operator spaces. We have a free product of phenomenon algebras, and we want to calculate the norm summation xi tensor xi bar in this phenomenon algebra. So these norms have been around for quite some time, closely related to injectivity, but of course these guys are not injective, so we have to actually find a good way of calculating these norms, but I will come back to this in a moment. And let me just tell you what's happening. So this term here, the supremum of the xi, again, no big surprise, everybody would have expected this. Then there is a nice guy here, where this is some kind of an L2 norm. Yeah? Also, if you think about it, you wonder maybe why do I have these two, A and B, to the right and to the left, but we have this symmetry. So again, this is something which is not really surprising. What is surprising is that these two other terms actually show up, but now, I mean, you have seen so many things about L4-third, the dual index of L4-third, L4, so not a big surprise, we see some four norms here, yeah? But in some sense, they are actually kind of cool because we are just multiplying our xi's to the left with something in L4 and to the right with something in L4, and then we hope that is going to do the job. This is L4, L4, and yeah, they are all L4 here, because if you want to go into L2 here, this is L4 and this is L4. Yeah, this is L4 and this is an L4. I mean, all the subs here are in L4, right, too, yes. But sometimes we do left, right, or both, right? I mean, it's just symmetry, which is playing the role here. There is something which is important, and I have to stress that. In some sense, we are only taking the coefficients here from the small algebra. And that is the crucial point. Yeah, if you were to do it with the large algebra, that's not going to work. Let's go for that. This is, yeah, the LT version of this result is harder. I mean, what I want to say is, this is some of the L-infinity version, and there is an LT version, and unfortunately, LT version is harder because our knowledge of harmonic analysis in the free group is not developed enough. I mean, there are certain things we don't know well enough, and Anyway, let's go to the proof of the Boyko-Lester inequality. So first of all, there is a formula for this. Namely, if you want to calculate these norms, this is an interpolation formula, again, discovered by PGA, that actually you can write these xi, xr bar just by left and right multiplication. It's a Neumann algebra, left and right multiplication through the makes a lot of sense. And then once you have that, then we are in the situation where you calculate xi to the left and xi star to the right, and in the middle, it easily, you can easily assume that this A here is an L2, and you can also make it positive if you wanted to. That's the technical thing. However, this A here is now in the large Neumann algebra, the free product. And these guys in the large Neumann algebra is way too large. We can't control this. This is hopeless. I mean, that's too big. And so we want to replace this A by something smaller, and something smaller means in the small Neumann algebra. Let's replace the guy from the large algebra in the small Neumann algebra. And then we have to play some tricks. So first of all, we somehow try to center that and whatever. What we do is we take an arbitrary element and then decompose it in those guys, which start from the left from something in AK or N from the right. I mean, we just take these, we consider this as an element in L2 with a lot of components coming from the words in the free product. I mean, this gives you a decomposition in L2, that's an orthogonal decomposition. And then we somehow try to split it up into starting from the left with something in AK, or starting from the ending with something, or then there's something which is left over. And so we are decomposing this, and what happens is that using freeness, we can reduce this expression to smaller terms. And the philosophy is either the input is small and the output is large, or the input is large and the output is small. So there's input-output, four combinations. These are the four combinations, that's where they come from. And the rest is our error terms. That's why we have four terms, right? And either make it small in the middle or small outside. And then that's it. But the argument is a little bit involved. At any rate, what is important here, and that's the main thing which bothers us a lot, is this is very L2 related, yeah? I mean, our element here is an L2, and there, these projections on elements starting with a certain symbol in AK is an orthogonal projection, therefore bounded. It is open, if you do the same trick in L4, it's still bounded. It's an open problem, and that's why our LP estimates are harder, because we don't know that these projections are bounded, and then we have to go an extra mile. Okay, combining these four terms, we see that this is now reformulating Boyko-Lester's inequality in an operator space setting, namely this intersection space with four terms, with these weights. I mean, this is just what we get. We get it, and what happens is this embeds into a space of the form L infinity with values in OH. So a vector-valued L infinity space. Now, there is a little bit of a warning. I mean, these underlying Neumann algebras, they are not injective, so vector value is a bit of an iffy question, but here it's not, because this L infinity of OH is just complex interpolation, and that's what we use in using PGA's argument, complex interpolation between L infinity of column and infinity of row. So that you can do in every Neumann algebra. Columns and rows are well defined in every Neumann algebra, so is the complex interpolation. Whether you can work it or not is a different story, but here that's exactly what we get. And then dualizing again, yeah, L infinity of OH, L1 of OH, this is dual to each other, and putting an embedding of OH in an L1, we get that for every subspace of a quotient of R plus OH and every subspace of a quotient of C plus OH, the Hagerup tensor product also embeds into L1. Yeah, so we knew that these individual guys embed into a non-commutative L1, and now we know that the Hagerup tensor product of these two guys embeds into L1. And I don't have many bar space models for such a tensor product result. They're certain, but of course, as I said before, the Banach space model, if this E and S is both L2, then it's boring. There's not much to say. But here the variety is a little bit larger. And the other result, I mean, Javier mentioned that before. So using our amalgamated version, if you translate that backwards, we get a completely bounded embedding of LPN into some LQM in the ranges which are possible, which are these ranges. Yeah. Okay, so this is where, well, and somehow where this all leads to, and I have some comments, namely the type 3 situation. So what I'm saying here is that even if this phenomenon algebra here n is semi-finite, then in general you would expect this phenomenon algebra to be of type 3. I mean, we can always make it a factor by making it larger. Anyway, so assume m is a factor, this factor has to be type 3, or to be said in a different way, there is no embedding with m being semi-finite. And there has been, I mean, that has been proved for OH by PGA, and we found a nice argument to show that OH does not go into a semi-finite head 1. And so is the situation here. So OH does not like to be in a semi-finite head 1. And so does LP. I mean, LP also does not like to be embedded, at least in a completely bounded origin in a semi-finite head 1. And this, of course, uses the transparent property. We have learned about this today, so I don't have to be so specific about this. I'm just recalling this inequality. There is some funny point, since we are here, there is some funny point about this inequality. It's very easy to write it like this, right? I mean, the free sum is the same sum as the... Actually, using a recent result by Kessler, we don't even have to assume symmetric. It suffices to do subsymmetric copies, which is a little bit, which actually occurs in many more circumstances than symmetry. So there's a large class of random variables where if you take copies, the norms are quite boring. It's always the same. Whatever you do, it's the same. We've seen that before with the Kinchin type inequalities. I mean, yeah. So there are certain situations where it's extremely rigorous. What kind of independence you use doesn't matter. The norms are the same. Period. At least if you sum all of first order. And what is misleading is that we are not, the way to prove that is we have a formula for that one and we prove that this formula holds for this. I mean, we are not proving there. I mean, the other way around. It's misleading to say that it's easier. It's just that we have a candidate for the right-hand side. And this candidate works out. And so many of our embedding results are essentially just reduced to this inequality, and the right-hand side can calculate using free probability and duality, and the left-hand side is what we get. So, and this is comment number one. And no, this is not working. Okay. So there are weighted Kinchin inequalities. I think I don't really want to do that. Yes, except for the only comment I will forget to make. So there is what came a little bit. What is kind of interesting here is that. We started to do the free inequality because free probability along has this huge tool for Golescu's inequality, and using this transparency principle you can somehow go from the free case back to the tensor product case. So what is interesting is that even for these finite matrices, I first had a very complicated argument to show these inequalities. You prove it in the free, then you do transference, there are some also products involved, and Abu Musab really found a more elementary proof for the Gaussian situation, I mean Gaussian variables, not the general Rosenthal kind of situation, but the Gaussian variables and in L1. But I think some people in the audience might have even tried to somehow push this argument for any p bigger than 1, and that seems not to work. I mean, we haven't found anything in that direction. So if you want to go away from 1, then this elementary argument again doesn't seem to work. But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, we know that there are always people coming up with extremely smart ideas once you know what's going on. Okay, so yeah, and the last comment I want to make is just an infomercial. So we have the point is I just want to comment a little bit on the other part of the argument why LP does not go into a semi-finite L1. And so let's assume it does. Yeah. Then the first step of the argument is to show if LP embeds into a semi-finite L1, then actually LP of 0,1 embeds into a semi-finite L1. That's because, you know, we knew before that then everything is over. And this actually is not as simple as it looks like, because there's always a difference between discrete random variables and continuous random variables. And in structure, these guys are very different. However, we have produced a lot of embeddings of little LP, of capital LP in little LP using an extra von Neumann algebra. So we use a certain technique, but what is kind of surprising is that we have a candidate of norms, right? I mean, once we have an embedding of little LP, capital LP embeds in an ultra product of little LP, for instance. Yeah, you can always write that down. But then this ultra product and semi-finite von Neumann algebras is not the love story at all. I mean, if you take an ultra product of semi-finite von Neumann algebras, you will be surprised. I mean, there are these type 3 objects appearing suddenly out of nowhere. And so there are some technical things that if you take ultra product, you have to be careful with what you're talking about. And what often you have to have is you have some kind of equi-integrability condition. Something has to be approximable by bounded elements in a good way. And just to do this little technical step, we actually need another result, namely the non-commutative Rosenthal result, which says that if you have a reflexive subspace, and our reflexive subspace here is this LP. Oh, that's nice and reflexive. So if you have a reflexive subspace of a non-commutative L1, then it is true what is also true, then you can find some P bigger than 1 and some density so that actually X is isomorphic to LP for some P bigger than 1. So every reflexive subspace in L1 is isomorphic to a subspace which is an LP for some P bigger than 1. And the P depends on the space and everything. And somehow the way this isomorphism is constructed is, as it should be expected, the change of density argument. So we find a linear map from X to LP of N, so that X can be written as a little bit density to the left, a little bit density to the right, and then this linear map. So this is actually another theorem which I produced together with Javier, and it took us also some time, but that's a different story. It's just that it just so happens that this theorem is the only way we can actually control these ultra products. So this is just a technical detail, but requires quite some work. And the good news is once we know what happens with LP of 0,1, we are back in track. I mean, everything from there was essentially known because, yeah, Kitchen inequality, right? RP plus CP embeds into LP of 0,1. That's the reformulation of the Kitchen inequality. And this RP plus CP is nasty enough not to go in any semi-finite one, and that is essentially revising Gilles' argument. So from here to here, that is all well known. We were in kind of safe haven, but the hard part was to get our space CP of RP at the end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? I have a question. About comment one, so there's a very interesting thing you said that three and independent are established, which is of course very striking if it's a particular case of a much more general phenomenon. So how in general can it be what we call it? Here the main restriction is their IID. I mean they're copies of the same thing.
So the IID restriction in my argument is totally necessary. I mean nothing I can prove. It would be very nice to remove the IID condition.
Because at the same time, it's evocative of the old situation at the beginning when you wish to care for the Kitchen inequality and then for Rademacher independent of Gaussian, and then there's this observation that the free case is the same thing.
Yeah.
So every time it seems like a coincidence and this thing really...
This one is not a coincidence. It's really that taking independent copies is very restricted. I don't really know how to explain it and prove it, but essentially there's one formula and that applies in all cases, and this one formula is really again, this is an algebraic argument. I mean, it's essentially using kitchen inequality, there is an algebraic construction which tells you how to find these elements of the dual. And this construction is universal. I mean, if you have good enough algebraic objects where you can write down these algebraic constructions, then it works. So it's not surprising that that in the subsymmetry is definitely enough to make these algebraic constructions. So this is some of my personal reasons for it. But it would be very striking to know when you cannot go away from copies. Because there are many questions about, I mean, what are, for instance, does every subspace of L1 contain a subsymmetric or a symmetric subspace? Open problems for reflexiveness. We know quite a bit, but I mean, so there are many problems about the structure of non-zero L1 spaces, which could be solved if you can extend this inequality in a larger setting, but that's totally beyond reach at the moment.
Perhaps I could record it with the group, but for instance, the completely isometric questions are open.
The completely isometric questions, even for H, are open. I think down where are the constants? 2, square root of 2, 10 watt? Square root of 2, right? Something like this. So it's very close. There's also Bojako's stream, of course. I mean, Bojako wants to find a concrete embedding somewhere. I think he would even take a concrete embedding in L1 if it comes from a group and something constructive. But again, we make this detour from going from the complex to some weighted real method, and this detour has the constant square root of 2 in it in some way. So the isometric question is just completely open in any category.
Yeah. So thank you very much.